Sure.
Excellent. Okay, for tonight's talk, it's another request. Came email a few days ago, and it's a very serious topic, but it's one which I am going to generalize so that please don't run away if you think this is just a bit too hard to talk about. But there's one thing as a Buddhist monk, you always want to tackle the deepest, hardest topics and find sort of good Buddhist solutions. And even if it doesn't apply to you, you can use these ideas for all aspects of a human life and actually get a lot of wisdom, but not just wisdom from ideas, wisdom which actually can free you from many of the difficulties and sufferings in life. And that is the revelations which keep coming out on the news of child sex abuse in religious institutions. And apparently just recently it was investigating some of the gross abuses in Victoria, in Ballarat. And somebody brought my attention to that, and some of the things I read there were absolutely gross. Please excuse me, but one of the things I read there was some sort of person, poor fellow, he said that when he was a young boy, 7 or 8 years of age, I think, if I remember correctly, to punish him, the nuns pulled his teeth out. It is disgusting. There's something very wrong there. But so, abuse, especially by organizations, such as religious organizations. You know, what is the problem there? And of course, once we identify a problem, we may be able to find some solutions, you know, for abuse in general. And lastly, about, you know, what do people do when they are subject to that abuse? And personally, I've never had sexual or physical abuse as a kid or even growing up, but you know, I did have my own experiences of emotional abuse 6 years ago when I organized, encouraged the ordination of women here in Perth and received a lot of emotional abuse from a religious organization trying to destroy my reputation, even bizarrely enough, trying to take away Bodhinyana Monastery from the BSWA, from our Buddhist society. But of course, you know, being a Buddhist monk and being a meditator, someone who has known and practiced these great teachings for a long time, you could endure that and just get your way through it. And I'm going to be using, saying some of the methods which, you know, I employ to actually to just not allow this to get to me or to sort of stop what I thought was the right thing to do, to give equity to women in a religion, especially in monastic Buddhism, not allowing that to cause any wounds or pain. So, this is a general thing which I'm going to talk about tonight. But first of all, we get, you know, the abuse from religions. And is it really a problem of, like, celibacy? Because, you know, you all know that Buddhist monks and nuns, you know, we are celibate. And certainly here in Perth, I do know of no examples of such sexual abuse, because there is a difference. Not only is that celibacy, you know, voluntary, you don't have to be a monk or have to be a nun. And if there's any time when a person feels that they do not like to live that celibate life, they can leave at any time. They can come back again afterwards. We don't have such a thing as life vows in Buddhist monasticism. And I think that's one of the reasons I feel very sorry for those religions which, once you join as a monk or as a nun, there is no way out. Because sometimes we make wrong decisions in life. As a young person, you may be inspired, you know, starry-eyed. You say, yes, I want to become a monk. I want to live my whole life for the sake of enlightenment and helping all sentient beings. I want to live the beautiful life of a renunciate nun, living simply and doing something good in this world. We may start like that, but later on in our life, we change. And one of the nice things about Buddhist monasticism is that you can leave whenever you really want to. So if you're not happy, Now, being a monastic, you can go whenever you want. One of the things with celibacy, it has to be a free choice, like everything else in life. No compulsion. And if you chose this path when you were young, and you feel you don't want to do it later on, fine, and please, with no stigmatism, with no blame, off you go and do another type of lifestyle. And I said to you, I think a few weeks ago, there's many of the monks who I ordained personally at Bodhinyana Monastery, they have disrobed, and they become excellent husbands. Honestly, their wives have come up to me afterwards and say, oh, thank you, Ajahn Brahm. You took my husband-to-be and you trained to become really sensitive and mindful and compassionate and doing all the chores in a monastery which young monks have to do. You trained him so well and now is my husband, having a wonderful time together. Honestly, women have said this again and again and again to me. So, you know, you don't lose anything, you know, by being a monk for a few years, you know, but if you want to stay longer, fine. So number one, the celibacy, you know, should be voluntary all the time, like everything else in life. When you're in a position where you feel stuck and there's no way out, that is one of the times which really affects, you know, the emotional stability of a human being, and which is one of the reasons why that people can do crazy things. But one of the most other things with religion is, again, the problem with hierarchies. Because wherever there's a hierarchy, I gave a talk about a year ago now, I think, about bullying and why it is that, you know, there are this problem in bullying, especially in schools, but also in organizations, you know, such as offices, corporations. You know, why is that? It's because of the hierarchies. Whenever there is a hierarchy, there's somebody who's got more power than others. And whenever there is more power than others, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, as Lord Acton used to say. That corrupting thing which happens with hierarchies. And with the best will in the world, if you are in a position of power, really good people come into positions of power, and after a while they tend to lose it. And this is one of the problems with being in positions of authority and power. The hierarchies are incredibly dangerous. We have to have those hierarchies often, but they should always have the checks and balances. So people in positions of authority and power have got someone other than their own religion to keep them in line. Religions cannot self-regulate, no more than the police department, governments, or anyone else can self-regulate. One of the reasons why, you know, that the French government in 2001, I often quote this when I give talks on human rights and religious freedoms. The French government in 2001 passed a law to limit religious freedom whenever it undermines basic human rights and human freedoms. It was actually saying that human rights and human freedoms, fundamental freedoms and human rights, are more important than any tradition, any culture, any religion. And I thought that was a wonderful, courageous and basically brilliant thing which the French government did. The religions, sometimes we say religious freedoms, that is the biggest thing in the world, and we should never even touch or infringe religious freedoms. And that's the problem. We do need sort of secular governments sometimes to be able to put limits on religious freedoms when they impinge on basic human rights and basic human freedoms. So I really often quote the French government that did a wonderful thing. I wish the Australian government would do that as well, and other governments throughout the world. And I say this as a religious leader, to curb the power of religions. One of the problems why there was so much abuse is because religions in that time had unbridled power. They were unquestionable, literally above the law, beyond the law, in their own eyes. Their religious laws was more important than anything else, and that was one of the big problems there. No organization should have such power. And in order to stop that, you know, obviously the secular law is important, but the whole idea of hierarchies, you know, when we do have things like popes and cardinals and archbishops and bishops and all these levels of authority, one of the reasons I felt comfortable in the Buddhist system was when you read, you know, the early Buddhist texts, if you go to the classes which people like Ajahn Sujato teach, you find there was no hierarchies there in the early Buddhism. And one of the incredibly powerful things which the Buddha said, you know, just before he passed away, and I keep bringing this back up again when I give lectures all over the world, was something which people don't realize, the power of this one statement, and how I think it was one of the reasons why the Buddhism has lasted such a long time in our world, why it has been able to go to many countries and survive and flourish. And that was when, just before the Buddha was about to pass away, he knew he was going, somebody asked him, once you're gone, who's going to be the leader of Buddhism? Who's going to be the big boss? And quite famously, the Buddha replied, no one is going to lead Buddhism. The Dhamma Vinaya, the teachings and the training which I've let down, that will be your boss, not a person, but the principles. That will be your leader from here on in. And with that one statement, it stopped the whole idea of archbishops, popes, ayatollahs, and anything else coming into Buddhism. Unfortunately, over centuries, people have tried to impose hierarchies on something which was never meant to be a hierarchical tradition. And for those Sri Lankans here, you know that in Sri Lanka you have things called Mahanayakas. Now, in Thailand, there's only sort of two sects. You know, the Dhammayutta and Mahanikaya. And we were having a joke at our monastery last week because somebody actually donated us another car. It was a ute, so we now call this car the Dhamma Ute car. If you're Thai, that's funny. But we only got two traditions basically in Thailand. But in Sri Lanka, I've asked Sri Lankan monks how many sects are there, and even they don't know. There's five or six big sects and subsects and branches of those subsects. There's sects all over the place. I meant SECTS. and all these sects have leaders. They call Mahanayakas. And one of my friends, he's a monk over in Malaysia, he did some research. It's great to actually have some research and find out where these things actually came from. And for those Sri Lankans, you know where Mahanayakas came from? The English. The English, when they went to Sri Lanka, the British Raj, they needed to somehow control this huge organization which had great power and respect, called the Buddhist monks in Sri Lanka. And so what they did, in true colonial style, and they were brilliant as far as politics goes, they chose convenient senior monks who were malleable, gave them a title, a fan regalia, and a bit of money as well, and established them as Mahanayakas. Thereby, the Brits could control the religion. It's brilliant. And that's where it actually came from. It was not original to Buddhism. The British did that, and that's one way they controlled the place. And that's also, please excuse me, what happened in Thailand as well. Give the organization there, and then the government can control the religion by giving these hierarchies. It was never meant to have hierarchies. It was totally devolved power. Every monastery was totally independent, not beholden to anybody. And even these days, people come up and say, oh, you know, the Dalai Lama, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, is coming to Perth next month. He's a leader of Buddhism. He's not the leader of Buddhism. Anybody who knows what Buddhism is, the three, well, what people say, three main sects, Here's sex again. You can't keep sex out of religion. Three main parts of Buddhism, you know, the Theravada, which is us, you know, the light brown robes. And we've got the Mahayana, which is usually the Chinese Zen people. And you've got the Tibetan Buddhists, you know, the Dalai Lama. So that's only a third of Buddhism. And of the Tibetan Buddhists, there are four major sects of Tibetan Buddhism. He's only just one of those, and he's not even the leader of that sect. So he's not even the leader of a quarter of a third of Buddhism. But, you know, he's just, you know, he's got a good personality, wise person, can speak. And so he's almost like the figurehead. So people look at him as the face of Buddhism. But he's got no authority. And he's never meant to have authority. No one has authority when it comes down to real Buddhism. And that is an amazing thing. If we can get back to that, if we could have a Christian church where there's no authority, no big shots, then there would be very little power. And the way that a religious organization, a church, a temple would operate, if it's a good temple, it will grow. It will prosper. If it's a bad temple, it will fade away. Just like trees in a forest, like flowers. If the seed is in a good place and it's nurtured, cared for, watered, it will grow naturally. You don't need to have a big person over the top forcing this one to grow and weeding out the ones they don't like. It's natural. And I gave this little simile to a group of directors in Bangkok a week ago, and they said, yeah, that's just like modern economy. You don't have too much control from the top. Throw out a few flowers, let 1,000 flowers bloom. That's what it meant by not having hierarchies and too much control. Power, control leads to abuse. And so one way of overcoming that is, please, let's somehow find some ways taking away the power structure of religions, organizations, anything. And it's not just celibacy, apparently, because I did keep up reading the newspapers. Even the good old Salvation Army, you know, had problems with abuse. It's not a celibacy thing. It's a power thing, and the abuse of such power. Now you can actually see how in your lives you can see, be careful of power. Always have some checks and balances, which you have to have. For me, in my authority, because I've got many disciples and people listen to what I say, and sometimes they fodder what I say, be careful. Just because I say it doesn't mean it's right. I always like telling the monks the story of some nuns in England who were being driven from, I think, from their monastery to the airport. And their driver had too much faith in authority. So when the nun, the head nun, told them, go straight ahead at the roundabout, that's exactly what the driver did. Straight over the middle of the roundabout. She went straight over the roundabout. That's not what I meant. Straight means, you know, you turn left and go round and then you go straight ahead. So that actually happened. It's crazy stuff, but sometimes... You couldn't believe it. But anyway, sometimes that's what I say these days, because when I heard that, I told the drivers I have. I say, no, go straight ahead at the lights when it's green. But you told me to go, and I've got belief in your psychic powers. Why did we get hit by a truck coming? You went through a red light. So, do you know how sometimes people are so gullible when you get people of authority? You just follow what they say, and, you know, you don't understand. So hierarchies is a big problem. But at least, like, in the original types of religion, you know, didn't have even hierarchies. Even in Christianity, they didn't have hierarchies at the beginning. That came later on. It reminds me of this story, this person. You know, they had one of these NDE experiences, which I like talking about, you know, when you sort of, you die and you go up somewhere and then you come back again and say what happened afterwards. This person, when they had an NDE, you know, they went up to a heaven realm and they said, no, you can't go, you've got to go back in, but, you know, have a look around first of all. And they said, I always wanted to find out and see God and see Jesus, because they were Christian. So, okay, fair enough, but you only got a short time, you've got to go back soon, otherwise I'll cremate you. So they went up and they saw God on his throne, but they never saw Jesus. Instead, they saw sitting next to God. This shows you just how hierarchies work up in heaven. They saw the cleaning lady with a mop and a bucket. So what's she doing there? And they told this person, and didn't you ever learn that cleanliness is next to godliness? That was a terrible joke for this evening. Cleanliness is next to godliness. So next to God is the cleaning lady. Does that count? Have I abused you? Are you going to take me to the Royal Commission? I think that sometimes you've got a good case for being abused by all my bad jokes for so many years to put me away. It's great when we don't have those hierarchies in organisations, and where we don't, for me anyway, just anything which I do, we've got the monks, and ask the monks who are with me, yeah, I do have authority, but these monks can keep me in line. And if they don't keep me in line, sort of the committee here can keep me in line, keep anyone in line, I can keep the committee in line as well. So there's a balance of sort of authority, which is really important in any organisations. So I think that's one of the big problems, the hierarchies in our world. So what are the solutions? And the solutions, obviously, is having small organisations, not big ones. The bigger you are, the more power, the more organisations you will need. And you know what it's like with big governments? Sometimes the big governments, they're not responsive to people who live in the outer lying areas. It means that they don't connect with people. It's important to be able to connect with people and to have sort of a contact with others. And then if we can actually start to let go of those hierarchies, and then we can actually be more sensitive, then actually that I think many of those problems can be overcome. But secondly, you know, the people who have suffered, you know, any of those abuse, which I think everybody here in one sense or another has suffered some type of abuse in the past. Many of us come here because we do feel that we've been victims of some terrible things, accusations which weren't true, and a lot of harm as well. And if that has ever happened to you, how do we use, or how do we manage to actually to understand how to go forward from that type of abuse? Obviously, one of the problems with people who have suffered abuse is that whatever's happened to them is not recognized. And one of the worst things is when you are abused, is people to say, no, it never happened, or just get over it, or just work with it. That is very, very disrespectful to the people who have suffered. Because number one, it's really important to respect people's emotional world. And even if you think it was a small thing, for them it may be a big thing. One of the great things, you know, with the commissions which are happening now in Australia, one of the great things with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which happened in South Africa, at least people had the chance to say what happened to them and have their version of events respected and acknowledged publicly. And there's a huge amount of healing when actually we bring things deep inside of us, which, you know, have been suppressed because people say, you know, just get over it, it didn't happen, or you've got no opportunity of redressing anything. When that's put down inside so deeply, that causes a huge amount of physical and emotional suffering. To be able to acknowledge or be acknowledged is one of the first steps in healing. Truth has to come out. And of course, you know, which is the right truth? As I said a couple of weeks ago, no one can actually say what is the right truth. Your truth, how you see things, how you experience those events, that is your truth. It may not be the same as other people's truth, but that is to be acknowledged and respected. And now, once it's respected, Again, a great catharsis happens. We're believed. How many of you have not been believed? And you know sort of the pain of that. It takes away, you know, your self-respect. Sometimes you think there's something wrong with you. When you have been hurt and no one acknowledges, you know, your reality. I often say that too often people blame themselves when this abuse happens. They think there's something wrong with them. And here I'm going to bring up karma. Please don't say that this must be my karma, that I have been abused. That is unacceptable, unhelpful. It doesn't really work. It's just like thinking that you're destined to be a victim. I see that, again, I told this to a young woman just beforehand. I don't know why it is, but this is my own experience of being in this job for 40 years. Women seem to take the blame so much more easily than men do. Whatever happens, a relationship doesn't work, a job doesn't actually eventuate, there's some failure in the business or health or whatever, why do you always take the blame? Thinking, I deserve this, there's something wrong with me. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's the Western culture of, you know, Adam and Eve. Sort of, you know, Eve just always being blamed. And Adam took the apple. But I always remember just the previous Archbishop of Perth. It was actually the present one, Roger Herft, when we did a sort of a talk together. And he told his story about, you know, those, many of you know the Adam and Eve story. And he said, if the Garden of Eden had been in China instead of the Middle East, there would be no problem. You know, if Adam and Eve had been Chinese instead of Caucasian, they'd have eaten the snake and not the apple. That was a good joke. Good on you, Archbishop. And that would have changed the whole of history. Anyway, I don't know why we keep blaming ourselves for these things. The blame game does not help at all. You know, in problems of abuse. Because sometimes blame the priest, blame oneself, that just gets into anger and the seeking of revenge and not the seeking of solutions. Revenge is not a solution. So, don't blame anybody. It's a hard thing to do, I must admit. But first of all, don't blame yourself. Allow the truth to come out. Punishment also doesn't help because, again, I've noticed this too often, whenever there's a fear of punishment, it drives the truth further underground. Who would really want to say what really happened? You know, if there's going to be a long prison sentence, there's some sort of even death sentence, who would want to tell the truth in the face of really very hard punishment? This is one of the reasons why I often cite the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, because in that there was amnesty even for some of the grossest of things which were done to people, torture and extrajudicial death. The amnesty was there because wise people like Mandela, Desmond Tutu, realized that whenever there was a fear of punishment, no one would tell the truth. When there was amnesty, you could tell the truth. You would suffer telling that truth. Your conscience would always be harassing you for the rest of your life, what you've done. You would never get away with anything. But whenever there was amnesty, it encouraged the telling of truth. We need to find out what really happened. You know, sometimes for the victims, the ones who did suffer, just seeing your side of the story acknowledged, seeing the perpetrator stand up and admit to what they've done, that is a lot of healing happens just there. Because sometimes, you know, I'm just, my sort of experience of abuse ordaining bhikkhunis was a small thing, nothing like that. But even so, sometimes I started to doubt myself. Am I really a bad person? Am I a bad monk? Have I broken my vows? Have I just abused, you know, my position? There is always self-doubt comes whenever you have criticism, and it's important to actually to have that doubt. As I told someone earlier, there's an old way of dealing very quickly with accusations made against you, and that is the story of looking at your bottom. If somebody calls you a dog, I wrote this, this comes from my teacher Ajahn Chah, if they call you a dog, don't get angry at them. If they call you a dog, look at your bottom. See if you have a tail. If you have a tail, thank you, sir, you're right, I am a dog. If you haven't got a tail, there's no problem at all. And this is actually where people do accuse you of something. Then actually you look, have I got a tail? Have I done something wrong? Could I have acted better? If so, thank them for pointing something out so you can actually grow and do better next time. Most of the time, accusations, abuse is totally unwarranted. So all you need to do, no, there's no tail there, and just walk away. Never actually believing them, because you see for yourself what you've done and why you've done it. If you can actually practice your life like that, then, yeah, people will abuse you. They will accuse you. You look and see whether you deserve it. If you do, thank them, do better next time. But a lot of times, you've done nothing wrong at all. So that is one of the reasons why I would look to see whether I deserved any of the abuse, which was when I was on the front page of daily newspapers in Thailand, you know, being accused of all sorts of stuff. That was just the tabloids in Thailand at the time, 6 years ago. But I looked at myself, they can accuse me, but I haven't done anything wrong. But I looked at it, and I asked my monks as well, have I done anything wrong? Is there anything else which I could have done in the circumstances? So that is the way you dealt with such abuse. Don't blame yourselves. And as I was told by another senior monk, don't blame others either. Never allow others to control your happiness, even when they say wrong things about you. Otherwise, they've got to you, they're winning. And I told that to, I just got a message from our former premier, Jeff Gallup. He sent, he's retired now, he sent me a little nice message with some Buddhist books. He's going to Europe for a big holiday, and he's retired from the University of New South Wales. And when he was premier here, I got quite close to him. And now that's one of the things which I said, which he valued a lot. Never allow others to control your happiness. Because he was a premier of a state. You know, cartoons drawn about him every other day in the West Australia. Every time he put his finger, I remember seeing a Liberal advertisement during one of the elections with Jeff Gallup having his finger in his ear. He actually put his finger in his ear because it was itchy, and of course somebody took a camera shot of him. That's the trouble when you're famous. Even the slightest thing which you do, people pick up on, and they take photographs of that. So, poor old Jeff, you know, allowing other people to control your happiness, he really got that. So he would not allow what other people said to control him and make him upset. And that's one thing, if ever you're a subject of abuse, they've tried to control your happiness. They've tried to torture you, abuse you, take away your happiness, take away your self-respect, take away your, you know, your esteem. Please, don't let them. Your happiness is totally under your control. It is your right. Exercise that right. And say, it doesn't matter what you say about me, what you've done to me, I am not going to let you destroy my life. I am going to be happy in spite of that. That is a very rebellious and very beautiful thing which you can do, which at one stroke, if you can do it, overcomes much of the abuse. But of course, you know, some of that abuse is so horrendous that, you know, how can we deal with it? You know, obviously you want to make sure it doesn't happen again. That's why I started off with some of the causes of abuse. and how we can actually somehow or other restrict the opportunities for such abuse as happened in those institutions. So, what do we do if someone has been abused? And some of the stories which I have said here over the years have been very powerful and are very effective. And the one story which, if anyone has had abuse in your life, really bad abuse, serious abuse, which I encourage you to try out because it has worked many, many times in a powerful and amazing way, is the adaptation of the story of opening the door of your heart. And for those of you who remember that story, it became the title of my first book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. It was when my father took me aside once when I was about 13 years of age in his old car, just in a road off Churchfield Road. It's actually Shakespeare Avenue, I think. It's amazing how you have this really good recall of events which happened such a long time ago because they were important for you. And he took me aside, parked his car, and said to me, "Son, wherever you go in your life, whatever you do, I want you to know one thing. The door of my house will always, forever be open to you." And that was it. And 13 years of age, my father died 3 years later. I never understood what he meant, only that somehow it was important. And later on, because when you become a monk or a nun, one thing which you do have is time. Time to meditate, time to be by yourself. When you're not caught up with relationships and families and getting on in the world, you do have that time. And I remember reflecting on these things, mulling it over, thinking about it. What did my father mean? It was important. And the insight came. He didn't mean his house. He meant his heart. And that just opened up floodgates of tears and wisdom and ways of dealing with problems in the world. What he was saying was, "Son, whatever happens to you, wherever you go, whatever you have to experience in life, the door of my heart is always open to you. You're my son, I'll always love you no matter what." No matter what was the powerful words there. And of course, I've used that many, many times. And if you are a victim of abuse, you can now use this. And how I describe this to people, this little exercise which you can do once you have the courage to do it, is you close your eyes and you imagine a heart in your chest. And to do this exercise, I recommend not a heart as you will see in an anatomy journal, not the real hearts, but use one of the hearts you will see on the Valentine's Day cards. Somehow it works much better. You know, pointed at the bottom, you know, with a little cleavage in the top. And imagine in that heart, in your chest, two big doors, closed, locked, padlocked. And you open those doors, wide open, fling them open, the doors of your heart. And then you imagine a staircase coming down, like they used to have in the old aircraft, just rolling down to the bottom. And at the bottom is those parts of you, that young girl, that young boy who was abused, who was raped, who was beaten savagely, who was whatever that abuse was. That's outside of you. You imagine that you, which is outside, rejected, because it's just too hard to embrace that. And the other part of you, the one which you're used to, which you can accept, is on top, inside the heart. And you call down to those little yous who have been hurt so badly, come up, come in to my heart. The door of my heart is open to you, no matter how badly you have been treated. And you imagine these little people, these little yous, when you were a young boy, young girl, maybe a young teenager or whatever, coming up, walking up those stairs, terrified, but coming up and meeting the other part of you. And this huge embrace, come in. You are part of me. I will never try and reject you or push you out or get rid of you ever again. With that embracing, with that coming in, with that inviting in, again, there's a huge change. Because people who have gone through hell, trying to reject that, trying to say that never happened, trying to forget it, does not work. But embracing it, this is who I am. This is me, this is my journey. And you embrace that. It takes a huge amount of courage. When you do that, there's a total change. Once it's embraced, then it's transformed. As I've often said here, the pain, the shit, becomes fertilizer for compassion and wisdom. You grow incredibly. No one else can do that for you. No one else can force you to do that. But if you try that, it's powerful. And because I've been teaching that for such a long time, there's many psychologists here in Perth actually employ that technique. They say it's incredible. People who have been tortured, they come back. They come back to life. That's who they are. They cannot reject it. They are now free. They are no longer being tortured. It's one of the problems. Is that when we don't embrace, accept, acknowledge, we hide it down, it will never disappear. Accept it, acknowledge it, admit it, then there's a chance of recovery. So those people who have, you know, been abused, they need to have, first of all, what happened to them, acknowledged by others, accepted. It happened. To know that they're not making this up. They are not sort of denied their truth. And then the hardest thing, to accept the truth yourself. And it's nothing wrong with me. Last story, which I've, again, one of these stories I keep saying again and again, but it fits into this talk. And sometimes people, they just take one of these talks and download it overseas. For those of you who have been abused, hurt, damaged, the old story about the most beautiful tree in the forest. The most beautiful tree in the forest, the natural trees are never straight. They never have all their limbs remaining. Many of those limbs or branches have been torn off by the storms. They never have beautiful green leaves all over the place. They have so many yellow leaves and brown leaves, and many of the green leaves they do have been eaten by bugs. And you look upon the bark of the most beautiful trees in the forest, and they're all damaged, bent, crooked, scarred by fires or by other injuries. And if you look at the most beautiful tree in the forest of all, it's usually the crooked, bent, damaged ones. Are the most beautiful. And if you look at any tree in the forest, they're all damaged. So if you are one of those so-called damaged goods, welcome. You are one of the trees in the natural forest which makes up humanity. You belong. And just a sense of belonging, acceptance, and turning that terrible thing which happened to a person into their beauty, into their strength. Accepting, being, instead of always rejecting. then the idea of being a victim is gone. They're not going to allow what happened to them anymore to victimize them. That's who they are, and they're beautiful as a result of it, like the trees in the forest. Then there's a chance that they can be free. Abuse. Why? Maybe how to solve the abuse of institutions in the future. And lastly, how to use this from being a victim to being a beautiful person. There are many stories in the time of the Buddha where that happened. They managed to take what happened to them and actually turn it into great wisdom, inspiration and power. Don't let whatever happened to you in the past take that power away from you. Regain it. Take it back. Maybe this way is a way which might work for you. Thank you for listening. Sadhu, very good. Sorry, that was a bit serious. I did try and put a couple of funny stories in, but sometimes you've got to be serious because that's really serious matters, which affects so many people. Okay, what have we got here from anything here? Anything from Cardinal Pell? Here we go, from Indonesia, Norway and USA. First of all, here we go. How to develop the out of control perception to apply in every moment. The controlling, as I said, when you're in power, you tend to want to control people. You know, if you look at your life, how much have you tried to control your life? And every time you try and fight, it doesn't really work. And deeper into Buddhism, where does control come from? It comes from the idea there's a person inside you who can control things, your ego, your sense of self. And the bigger your sense of self is, the bigger your ego, the more you tend to control, quite frankly. So in our life, we learn learn to try and lessen our sense of self and ego. You can try that when you have a relationship. Relationships are very difficult if you or one person in a relationship has big ego. You have to sublimate your ego, your sense of self, to the couple. You're a partnership, you're a relationship, you're not an individual anymore. Which means you have to do a lot of letting go to live with another person. You can't control it so much anymore. And then later on you have family. Again, you have to really let go of a lot of ego to live in a family. When you have kids as well, those of you who have been mothers and fathers know just how much you have to let go. You can't control. You have to just put aside your sense of self, what you want, for the sake of others. Or for the sake of, not others, for the sake of us. So the more you have a sense of us rather than a sense of me, the less you will control. From Norway, should we as Buddhists get involved in politics, or is it better to avoid arenas where conflicts and arguments can occur? A few years ago, when I was visiting England, that's where I grew up, where I was born, give a keynote at a human resources conference. I get some really interesting gigs as a monk. No, HR, human resources. They still want a monk to teach. And when I was there, the guy who picked me up from the airport, a Sri Lankan fellow, he had been appointed as Buddhist chaplain to the British Army. And he announced that there was a seminar happening in a week or two's time. Can I come and speak in the seminar for Buddhists in the British Army? So straight away I thought, well, these can't be real soldiers fighting in Iraq and Syria. This must be the dentists or the accountants. Just like we had a monk in Bodhidharma Monastery, just a visiting monk for a year or two, and he was a Gurkha. Remember the Gurkha soldiers in the British Army? I remember just one of their mottos. You always know when a Gurkha has been, because you wake up in the morning and you shake your head and it falls off. That's the sign the Gurkhas have been. And this was a Gurkha. He was a monk, you know, from Nepal, in our monastery. And everyone was really impressed. A Gurkha? Wow, you must be really mean. He said, yeah, I worked in the accounts department. He was just an accountant. But anyway, that's where he was working. So that's what I thought. The British soldiers who were Buddhists, they'd all be like accountants and dentists and stuff. But when I got there, these were frontline soldiers. You know, people who actually would go, you know, in the front line with the machine guns and shoot people. And my mind has to be open. You don't say, bad Buddhists, you know, you're killing people. You say, I wanted to find out, why? How can you be a Buddhist? Because these were intelligent people. How can you be a Buddhist and be a soldier at the same time? I listened. And when they actually told me that, I came away from that, I said, I'd rather have Buddhists as soldiers in the army than any other religion. They're mindful, compassionate. They're really trying hard not to shoot out of anger or get stressed out. I thought, wow. I changed my whole attitude to it because I listened to them. Politics. Is it bad to be in politics if you're a Buddhist? Goodness gracious, I mean, think politics needs some change. So why not Buddhists? But be careful because you can get too much power. I think Buddhism may be able to maybe change things a little bit. Some of our ideas, psychology, basic assumptions about life and its meaning, even things like reincarnation. It would be great if our political leaders believed in reincarnation. I'll tell you why. If Obama, Cameron, Abbott believed in reincarnation, if they knew that they were going to come back to this planet, they would do much more to stop climate change. Because they would have to come back and they would have to experience what's going to happen. Many of these politicians are so old, they know they're not going to have to suffer, you know, the effects of their bad decisions on the climate. They're out of here before the sea level rises. But imagine they have to come back and live in a world which they destroyed. Would they not be more responsible? One life is just like going in a holiday home for a few years. You don't really have to look after it. But if this is your house and you're going to be in here for years, for many lifetimes, your attitude towards it changes. You have to look after it. So I think maybe Buddhists, especially people who believe in reincarnation, they're going to have to come back here. I think they would make much better politicians. They have to see the big picture instead of just the next election, because they've got to come back. So, yeah, why not? If child abuse is not karma, then how to get over the feeling that it is a dark cloud hanging over the lifespan? What I'm saying, karma, it is not something which I did something wrong in the past, therefore this must happen to me. That is, again, blaming yourself. I was raped. Must be I'm a bad person to get this. That does not help at all. That is what I meant when people say, oh, it's karma that you got abused. It's karma you got raped. You're paying off old debts. That does not help at all. That just continues this idea that you're not worth anything, low self-esteem, you know, which is one of the things which get taken away from you when you're abused, your self-esteem. And someone comes, oh, it's your karma, you deserve that. That just takes more of your little remaining self-esteem away. That's why I don't like that idea. But the law of karma, as I understand and as I've been teaching it for many years, don't think this is why it happened to me. That's karma from the past, if it's karma at all. How about the karma of the present? What are you doing about this right now? in this difficult situation, painful, disgusting, what are you doing about it? The karma of the present is, you know, what I like about Buddhism. You can always make something out of the worst ingredients. You can, as I always say, you can make mangoes out of dog shit. You know, you can make incredible things out of the worst ingredients. I don't know, some time ago I saw this documentary. Every now and again people send me on the internet little video clips of these really inspiring stories. There was this, I think in Venezuela, the Rubbish Tip Orchestra or something, where kids, you know, living next to a rubbish dump, they took all sorts of rubbish there. I think it was actually coming from the United States. They were wasted in the United States and dumping it in their village in Venezuela somewhere. And they got, and they made musical instruments out of this stuff. And such innovative instruments. And they got some conductor, taught them music, and they got this orchestra, you know, out of old oil cans and broom handles and string from here or whatever. And it was just so inspiring to see just out of rubbish these poor kids could make this incredible music. I think, what was it called? The Rubbish Tip Orchestra or something, if anyone has seen that little clip. That's the sort of thing which is inspiration, because that just shows you how out of rubbish you can make this incredible music. That's what karma is. Out of the rubbish which has been given to you, you know, for the abuse which has happened, the karma is you can make something beautiful out of that. So you don't have to be a prisoner of the abuse. There is the opportunity, the path to freedom and even to be an incredible human being. And that accepting, embracing, transforming, that's basically how it works. That's the karma. Otherwise, people who have been abused when they're kids have to be abused for the rest of their life. There's no escape from that, Jiao. I want to offer that key out of that incredible bad past which people have been through. They can get out of jail and they can become such amazing people, wonderful people, much better than me because of what happened to them. The more stinky, smelly, disgusting the shit, the sweeter the mangoes. That's the law of karma. Okay, I'm getting too serious, sorry. Any questions from the floor here before we finish off? Serious subject. I don't know if I made a good job of it, but I tried my best. Yes. Yes.